and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm your host, Jack Mao, on faculty with the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center of Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, how you doing?
Here I be. I'm doing fine, thank you. We're enjoying our summer, aren't we?
Yes.
It's been a good time. Just have to keep vermin out of my attic.
Yeah, I've heard you've had some uninvited guests.
Yeah, it seems I have a hole or two in my attic someone's chewed in. Nobody I know personally, I think, but somebody has. And we actually had one of the little babies of this somebody wandering about my office the other day.
Right. It's a possum, in case everyone's wondering. Everyone's on the edge of their seats, like, what is it? Is it like...
When they're little babies, these possums are a little cute. They grow up to be pretty hideous,
and pretty mean.
And they hiss and bite, and
they are the chimpanzee of the rodent world.
Golly, they're awful. So anyway, we've got a guy out here looking to see if he can't help me get rid of them. I trapped two of them myself.
I'm proud
to say.
Oh, the adventures we have here at the Center for Western
Studies. That's right. The summer adventures at the center.
Oh,
well, last week we were talking about this conference that's being held in St. Louis.
Right, the Revoice.
The Revoice Conference, right. And we read through a couple of bits of website information from the Revoice people themselves and from the conference leaders and debated some of the issues that come from that. There's quite a bit of controversy, I think, in the Reformed world right now about how to address the homosexual issue. We dealt with a couple of things, but what we didn't deal with was maybe the most important issue at the core of it all. Mm-hmm. This question about whether or not homosexual attraction is itself sin. Mm-hmm. I think most everybody would agree, every Christian that is serious about the scriptures would agree, I think, that homosexual practice is pretty much outlawed. I say pretty much because I'm trying to be nice. It is outlawed.
Right.
Not because of any animus against homosexuality, as homosexuals, but because of the picture that we get in scripture of what sex is all about. Mm. Between a man and a woman, in marriage, monogamous, And if that's the definition of it, then anything outside of that is wrong, including homosexual activity.
Right.
So, but if we agree on that, what about the sexual attraction? When we read through the websites, what we found was that the leaders were using fairly trendy terms like gay Christian or LGBT Christian,
right,
or that
intersectionality.
Intersectionality, right? And those are terms that can be used and have been used by some people to acknowledge that homosexual activity is actually acceptable before God. If I'm a gay Christian, does that mean that I'm a practicing homosexual? Well, we kind of went through that, but the question still remains: is there a category for that term, that prefix, gay Christian, if gay in that way means simply attraction, mm-hmm, homosexual attraction?
Yeah, last time we dealt with like the verbiage and rhetoric of what they're saying, because that was one issue.
Right.
It was like,
right,
the terms they were using and how helpful or unhelpful they were, whether bringing that stuff out was, a good criticism or if it was straining at gnats.
Right.
The other criticism is, like you said, was on the point of attraction, because the Revoice Conference, it's being hosted by a church in St. Louis, but they're not the ones who started the conference. The ones who started the conference was the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender.
Right.
Which I think we mentioned last time. It's the president of it, last I checked, was our friend Preston Sprinkle, the Nashville Statement.
Yeah, who commented on the Nashville Statement.
Yeah, last year.
Right.
And, So the other side of it came in from two points. One was certain, I think I mentioned last time, curmudgeonly sort of, but articulate responses to the Revoice conference. And on the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender, their website, they had a six-point statement of marriage, sexuality, and gender.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the more curmudgeonly voices was sort of harping on one point here.
Oh, yeah.
But I'll read the 6 points.
Yeah, what are the 6 points?
So the six-point statement on marriage, sexuality, and gender from the center, not our center, the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender,
right.
is a one. Number one, according to God's design and intent, sex difference, male and female,
right.
is an intrinsic part of what marriage is.
Right.
While same-sex marriage is legal in some countries, it does not represent a historical Christian view of marriage.
No problems there.
That's number one.
Good.
Number two, and this actually goes to something you just said a few minutes ago, all sex outside of marriage is sin.
Right.
All of it. Not just homosexual, but heterosexual and right. any other sex.
It's important to see that it's not singling them out.
Mm. Number three, the fall has corrupted God's original intent for human sexuality in all persons.
Amen.
Therefore, all people, straight or non-straight, experience corruption in their sexuality.
Fair enough.
So that builds off of the second point.
Right.
Number four, simply experiencing attraction to the same sex, or being gay, as mm-hmm. it says here, is not in itself a morally culpable sin.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Number five.
That's the one that maybe we should talk about.
Yeah. Number five, God desires all males and females to express their gender in accordance with their biological sex. Now, that's like straight up. That's like straight up Catholic, right?
Yeah.
There. That's about as orthodox catechismic as you can get.
Yeah.
Not sure if catechismic is a word, but I like it.
It is now.
And then number six, all forms of abuse, slander, dehumanization, or oppression towards fellow humans
yep.
is an affront against God's sacred image, which has been stamped upon all people.
Amen. That's a very important point.
Yeah, so all six of those look like pretty like, okay, like I can get on board with this, but it is that fourth one.
Before you get to the fourth one, I think that's right. We ought to spend the time on the fourth one. The fifth one is interesting. Can you just read it mm-hmm. for me again?
God desires all males and females to express their gender in accordance with their biological sex.
Right. So that connects sex and gender. Mm-hmm. A lot of the discussions I have, even among Christians nowadays, young millennials especially, is that the argument is that sex is biological and gender is socially constructed. Mm-hmm. Right. And that sounds like it's saying, whether that is or not, this is how it needs to be expressed. So your biological sex describes how your gender ought to work.
Right. The way when I said like that straight up Catholic in like the again, Mark Barnes, he focuses a lot on gender stuff. He said the Catholic like catechismic teaching on this is that your biological sex and your gender expression is supposed to be in harmony with each other.
Right. That's
like
right.
They're supposed to be harmonized in some way.
I think that makes a lot of sense. It's a dangerous thing, I think, to untie those two that way. I mean, you can argue that I can see why they might want to define them as separate things, but they need to be linked together the way that number five seems to work. So I think that makes sense. But it just flies in the face of a lot of teaching.
It does. I mean, if you argue that something is socially constructed, in some way, you could say, okay, so what? Like, doesn't mean it's false or wrong or bad. I mean, if we constructed it together, did we construct it wisely? Did we construct it in a way that is connected to truth?
Right.
Okay?
That's right.
Syllogisms are constructed.
Sure.
Okay? They do not occur naturally in nature.
Right? Right.
Right? So it's like something, just because something is constructed doesn't mean it's false or wrong. It depends what. But there is something in social construction theory that wants to say that if something is socially constructed, well, it's just arbitrary.
Then it's arbitrary or relative.
It has no groundings in reality whatsoever.
Right.
And what this is saying, if I could put it in other terms, is that God desires all male and females to express their gender construction, if you want to use it that way, in accordance with the reality of their biological sex.
Right.
So it's
that's what it says.
Make your constructions and reality, you know, harmonize together in some way.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's very good. Most of the time in my life, I think people have just used the words sex and gender interchangeably. Mm-hmm. But if they want to make a distinction like that, it may be helpful, that distinction.
It may be.
But I'm with you altogether about the idea of constructions being based in the truth and frankly, based in the nature of things, which is what we've got to deal with.
I mean, see, that's the catch. And the whole sex gender thing is tricky because people say like, well, it's just gender is just social construction. And you want to say, no, it's not. And then people say like, oh yeah, so only boys can wear blue.
Right.
And then you're like, okay, fine. So societies do construct images and ideas of what this is what a man is like and this is what a woman is like, and they aren't always accurate, but that's the catch. They're not always accurate compared to what?
Yeah.
Right? So it's like your constructions have to be reflective of some reality. And like a gender spectrum person would say that, well, gender is this amorphous spectrum that has no center and has no anything. So all constructions are equally, well, they're equally invalid, but then that just makes them equally valid because it's like, you know, no matter what.
But so if you say, so you construct it for yourself.
Right. But if this is arguing that whatever construction of gender you make, it has to be grounded in the reality of your bodily, biological sex. It has to be grounded in something concrete.
That's right. I think the problem is, just like every sin, we don't like the idea of anything telling us that we can only do certain things. We just don't like that. We all bristle with that idea. But God actually does have... God has actually created things in certain natures, has certain realities there that we have to relate to. And it's unwise, simply unwise, to say, I'm on the top of this building and I'm just not going to believe in gravity today. I'm just going to jump off and assume that I can fly. And reality somehow sets in.
Yeah, it's an absurd example, but it's like, that's kind of the problem, is like the absurdity that we're stepping into. I don't think that people who buy into the gender spectrum notion genuinely buy into it. They're not being insidious or mendacious or something like that. They like sincerely buy into it and think it's a good thing. I don't think those people realize what a threat that type of thinking is to the body itself. The body moored from, you know, gender, you know, unmoored from the body is bad enough, I suppose. But then making gender actually hierarchically superior to the body.
Right.
My gender feelings, how I construct my gender is more important than the body. Therefore, I'm going to get cosmetic surgery and stuff.
Right.
If technology gets, you know, good enough, we get a sort of not just a transsexual, but a transhumanist sort of thing.
Yes, right.
Then I can actually, you know, take cybernetics and completely alter who I am. It's this type of stuff is a threat to the body itself, like the concretion of the body that God made, right? And so,
right.
That's a whole other ball of wax. But it is, number five is interesting in that it says we have to take, okay, so maybe our gender expressions are something we construct, but our constructions need to be grounded in something true. And our bodies are true. They're real. They're right there. It needs to be grounded in reality.
Right.
And I think that is a helpful way to talk about it. Still controversial way, but it's helpful.
I think that particular point would stick in a lot of craws. In I'm talking about even among Christians, and millennial young Christians, millennial Christians especially. But all right, but let's leave that as it is and head on to number four there.
All right, number four is the one. This one specifically, because like I said, one of the more curmudgeonly but articulate responders against the Revoice thing pointed this out specifically. So number four. Simply experiencing attraction to the same sex or being gay, again, this is what they say on their thing,
right,
is not in itself a morally culpable sin. They took that to task.
Uh-huh.
All right? They took that to task because, and somebody responded against them, and this is basically how I understand the two arguments to go.
Okay.
On the one side, it says attraction is something you cannot help. Right. You don't choose it. You know, you could just be walking down the road and somebody passed you. Forget about being homosexual, heterosexual. You just be walking down the road and somebody attractive to you walks by and then suddenly it's just there. Like you just notice, right? I suppose with guys it's maybe particularly interesting because we're visually wired and all that jazz. Or more visually wired.
I think we are.
Sure. But still it's like attraction just happens. All right. You can't control that. So you can't be held morally culpable for that. You only can be held morally culpable if you choose to follow it and act on it.
Act on it, yes. Right? Got it.
So that's the one side. The response, the counterpoint, as it is that same-sex attraction is, by biblical definition, a disordered desire.
Uh-huh.
All right?
Uh-huh.
And because it is, by definition, a disordered desire, the very attraction itself is sinful.
I see.
Like, even if you can't help it, it doesn't matter because it's still wrong. Like, it's wrong. And thus, saying that, well, it's actually not inherently sinful is actually kind of opening the door too much. I'm giving sort of the nicer version of it. It's like opening the non-nice version was, like, you're basically just capitulating that homosexuality is not sinful at all.
Uh-huh.
The nicer version is that by making that distinction, you're kind of opening the door for somebody else to later come along and try to argue that homosexual behavior itself is not biblically sinful or something like that.
Because the attraction is not sinful, maybe the action is not sinful.
Right. So, so it's like...
Right. Well, I think we ought to focus on the first part of that, the attraction question, because that's really the issue. If it's possible to say that homosexual attraction is not inherently sinful, then I guess I can go along with using a term gay Christian. Right. That would have a little bit of meaning. We can talk about whether that meaning is worth holding to.
Sure.
If the damage done by it is something we want to oppose.
Right.
But
even if
I can at least see there's...
Even if it was accurate, that doesn't mean it's useful.
Exactly. But it could be an accurate category. But it seems to me if you take the other side of it, that is that the attraction itself is inherently sinful, then there can't be any need for a category gay Christian, because it would be inherently contradictory. Does that make sense?
It'd be like saying, an adulterous Christian.
Exactly,
Which may be accurate, but then even just saying it is like, well, you shouldn't be that, because like adultery is sinfulness. But there you go, like adultery is an action.
Correct.
Right,
correct.
So like, when I say like gay Christian is, as the statement says, being gay, you see the quotation marks I'm making with my hands, is being gay, having those attractions, is that in itself sinful? And this is the weird thing. This is the weird dichotomy that I find strange, frustrating, and fascinating at the same time.
Mm.
Is that the one side is saying because sin is by definition some kind of action, whether it's a physical action or like a thought action, if you understand what I mean, like you entertain those thoughts or something like that, that's a choice. It's a choice. Right, it's a choice you make.
Okay.
Okay, so sin...
It's based in will.
It's a will thing.
Okay, right, okay.
So if you have attraction, you can't will attraction. That just happens.
Right.
All right, so that's not a sin.
Right.
The other side wants to say that God clearly states what sexual attraction is supposed to look like, and anything outside of that is by definition disordered, and I would say the word, it's fallen. Like, this is a product of the fall.
Right.
And that's not good.
And you're making a distinction then between fallenness and sinful practice.
Sinful practice.
Yeah, okay.
And the thing is, it's such a weird, weird distinction. In any other situation, it doesn't feel like it would be a weird distinction to make, but here it is, because it's like, on the one hand, you want to say, well, yeah, sinful practice is sinful. That's the sinful practice. But it's like homosexual behavior is sinful. Having homosexual attractions is fallen, it's just a product of the fallenness. Like, just anyone else having, like, other... I can't think of any example that doesn't sound insulting.
Uh-huh.
All right? Like, my immediate example is, like, is having homosexual attractions like committing a sinful act, or is having homosexual attractions like having some sort of, born with, like, a genetic disorder? Which sounds incredibly insulting to people, have, like, oh, you're just a genetically disordered. But understand what I'm trying to say. It's like, Christians...
Is it the same kind of thing?
There's a tradition in Christianity that things like disease, for example, or being born with a birth defect,
right,
or even natural disasters, some people push it that far, the whole all of creation is groaning under stuff. All that stuff is a product of the fall.
Right.
Like cancer, if you have cancer,
yeah,
that is a product of the fall, but it's not your fault.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right.
So it's like if you have or if you were born with a tendency towards alcoholism because your mom drank while she was pregnant or something like that.
Sure.
Alcoholism, being intemperate in regards to drunkenness, is the biblical term, drunkenness, is sinful. Okay, so if you're born with sort of that innate sort of drive towards it, that's product of the fallenness. Because your mom sinned, but of the fallen world, but that's not your fault. It's only your fault if you act on it.
Uh-huh.
So the question the question seems to be, is homosexual attraction, is it like being born with the fallen thing, or is it like making an actual choice?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's what I mean. And
That's a tough distinction in this particular way. I like to try and take it outside of the sexual realm and see if it applies to other in areas that we understand are less sort of controversial, you know?
If I had
an ongoing desire to steal, if I were a kleptomaniac, mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether even that word is a useful word in a discussion about, you know, sanctification, but maybe, I mean, it's a sort of psychological
word. You have a tendency towards the five-finger discount.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But, I mean, let's say I have a kind of desire, because that's what kleptomaniacs say. I can't resist it. I have this desire to steal. It's just a great thrill, you know. And I mean, I'm like Augustine in his Confessions, he, you know, stole these pears, but he didn't do it because he was hungry. He just did it because it was fun to steal. And he realized in himself that was part of sin, right? Well, if I had a desire to steal, but I resist it because I'm a Christian, I know that's wrong, I recognize the scriptural commandment not to steal, and so I resist that as best I can, and maybe I fall occasionally, but maybe I'm even 100% able to resist this temptation. Then would I call that? Would I call myself a kleptomaniac Christian? See, is that a meaningful category? And if it is, it would be because I'm trying to say to the world, this is my particular temptations. Everybody has different temptations, right? But this particular one really gets me. I have to watch myself in this area. You could have a gambling, you know, problem, or you could have alcohol problem, and you're resisting.
Or you could have a, you know, fearful problem, like you're just
sure, anxiety.
You lean towards being anxious and untrusting.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a temptation too, I think, a temptation not to trust. Mm-hmm. So, would I call myself a trustless Christian?
Yeah,
you know, an anxious Christian? Is that what I would do? I mean, I don't think I would.
Yeah, well, yeah, it's another issue of like, well, maybe it would be accurate, but how useful is it?
Right.
And
right.
The thing is like we're saying all this. We take it out of the sexual realm because it's helpful, but you can hear people being like, well, look, kleptomaniacs don't identify as like a group together seeking for rights, right? But that's, I think that's kind of our point. It's like, that's what I said when I said, like, I can't think of an example that isn't insulting. I was trying to be like, you know, have tact and stuff like that. But at the same time, it's frustrating because why are we identifying by our sexuality at all?
That's my question, really.
Like,
yeah,
why is that even, why is that even a thing?
Yeah.
That somehow your sexual practice, you know, who you hook up with, if I may say it that way, is somehow a fundamental core part of who you are.
Yeah.
Like, when did that happen? And why did that happen? And why does it continue to happen?
We did touch on this idea of identity last time, I think, a little bit. And that's important. That we're Christians, we're not adjective Christians. Mm-hmm. And I think that helps, because if you associate yourself with a particular thing, like the sin that you struggle with or whatever, and turn yourself into a member of a group of Christians, it's a subset of Christianity, I wonder if maybe it doesn't limit the ability of the Christian to respond to God's sanctification process. Mm-hmm. You know, it may be that he wants us to give that up, whatever that is. I don't want to see myself as a kleptomaniac Christian, or an anxious Christian, or a gay Christian, or I wouldn't call myself a heterosexual Christian for some of the things you were just saying. That basically, we've got a sort of hypersexualized culture, and so it's understandable that sometimes people associate themselves with certain kinds of sexual practice. But Christians don't need to do that, seems to me.
Yeah. It feels like it's another issue, but just one point to it. It just feels like part of this discussion would be a lot easier if this practice wasn't seen as some sort of identity.
Right.
You know, if we just talked of it as like just an activity, just an action that people take, then it's no different than like any other action someone takes. Then we could talk about it in sinful terms and whatever that, and it didn't seem like it would be nearly as raucous. But because it's become, for whatever reason, you know, that's another discussion. But for a reason, it's become sort of an identity people hold to.
Right.
Now you have to, like, there's a sense of you have to walk on eggshells around this. And to the counterpoint, there's some people who are so sick of that they don't want any tact whatsoever when dealing with this issue and just come in with, like, both barrels blazing,
right,
so to
right.
speak. And so trying to shoot that gap where we recognize that for good or ill, for valid or invalid reasons, people identify with this thing, we think that's foolish, but they identify with it. So therefore, we must be gracious when dealing mm-hmm. with the situation.
Well, I think that's the method or the understanding of the Revoice bunch are trying to do. They're saying, well, because of the things you just said, we have to find a way to have a conference that will address how Christians might address this group.
Right, and it seems like the other side feels like any, well, let me not say that. I was about to say that they feel like any attempt at conversation is by definition capitulation. And I almost didn't want to say that because it makes it sound like they just don't want to have any conversation with those people. I don't think they would say that. I think they would say we do want to have a conversation. But I feel like their conversation would somehow be like no quarter given sort of thing, like no space at all. Uh-huh. All right, let me read. So I got two quotes here. One was from one of these guys who I cast on the curmudgeonly side, although he's way more articulate and like...
An articulate curmudgeon.
And way more commonsensical in ways. And I got a quote here, but I'll just read this one line that's basically the crux of his point. His claim is, quote, "To desire what God forbids is a sin." Full stop.
Yeah.
All right? The mere desiring of what God forbids is sinful. Not even acting on it, mere desiring it. All right?
Wow.
The counterclaim by someone who was responding to this article is same-sex attractions are disordered attractions. They are as much a result of the curse or the fall as earthquakes and dental cavities. But they are not sin unless and until they are indulged as lust or sexual activity. So there's the two things. On the one hand, merely desiring what God forbids is sin. On the other hand, same-sex attraction is a part of the fall. It's no more. Right. It's just part of the fall. It says earthquakes and dental cavities, which are much better examples than what I was giving. Mm-hmm. And there you notice they use two different words. One says desire, one says attraction. And this makes me think of Jesus, because why not? We're all Jesus Christians here, right?
Right.
All right. There's two things.
I'm a Jesus Christian. Talk about it. As opposed to what?
I don't know. It was a sidebar. A friend of mine in college tried to tell my brother he was going to start his own religion called Godism.
Godism.
Yeah, where he was just going to love God. Then that was basically it. And my brother looked at him and said, "Well, can I be a Christian goddess?" And that just sort of ended the whole thing. Anyways, Jesus. One thing he said and one thing that was said about him.
Uh-huh.
One thing he said was that if a man looks upon a woman and lusts after her in his heart, he's already committed adultery.
Right.
Right? So there's the whole desiring what God forbids.
Right.
Right? So, like, the guy didn't actually do something physical, but then on the other hand, he did do something internally.
Right.
So he acted upon that desire.
And the purpose of that mainly was to let the Pharisee types know that the law was much more profound than they could ever imagine, and to try and keep it then is a foolish notion. You can't possibly. So in this particular example, I'm going to let you finish your point in a second. In this particular point about the idea that there's lust in your heart, Jesus was basically saying that's how deep it all goes. There's nothing you can do about that.
Right.
You know, and except turn to me and let me give you a new heart. There's that.
Right.
Okay.
So that's the one side. I feel like the sides of, like, you know, to desire what God forbids is a sin, full stop, is something they would point at. You know, like, that's one thing. The other thing, and it was something Jesus did and it was something said about him, was that Jesus was tempted.
Right.
On all points, yet without sin.
No sinning. That's right.
Exactly. So we understand that to mean that there's a difference between sin itself and just being tempted to sin, right?
Right.
That, you know,
even if the sin itself is internal, like that lusting after the heart. So what you're saying is there's a difference between being tempted to lust and lust,
right?
For example.
So that, see, it seems the coin, because it looks like that's the two sides of the coin, because the guy who says, like, to desire what God forbids, and the other one says that same-sex attractions are disordered attractions, I feel like, are they using the same terms?
Yeah.
I mean, well, clearly they're not, but, like, do they even mean them the same way? And does the Bible even mean them the same way? Are same-sex attractions, to use these guys' terms, are they desires or are they attractions? To use biblical terms, is it a lustful thing?
Mm-hmm.
Or is it simply a temptation?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's interesting to think, like, Jesus was tempted, right? for its temptation to mean anything, it had to have purchase somehow, right? It can't be fake. It can't be like he was tempted but not really, you know,
because
he couldn't really be tempted, but we just say no, there had to be something that when the devil tempted him in the wilderness, it actually could work. And it is part of the mystery of like the incarnation, that because Jesus was in a body that could get tired and hungry and die, it was technically, if I can say this with piety, all right, it was technically a fallen body. You know what I mean? It was a body subject to the fall because it could die, it could get hurt, it could get hungry, it could whatever. I mean, there somehow there was something that could be appealed to that was not sinful, but it was
human,
temptable. Yeah, it was human in some way, which that in itself was an interesting discussion. But so somebody's like, is same sex attraction, is it temptation or is it actually like something more? Is it like the lustful desiring?
I think we want to be sure we clarify that you're not saying anything against the perfection of him as a human being.
All right.
Because the fact that he was born of a virgin, you know, is absolutely essential to Christianity for the idea that he's holy. But also, we know from the scripture that he was tempted in every way humanly possible. Mm-hmm. So your point is excellent. I think your point is right. As long as people, our listeners, don't think that what you're saying is that somehow his body was fallen and yet he was not. I think his body was not, well, he was living in the body of a human being, a son of Adam, but it was a unique birth, right? So,
yeah.
But your point, though, that human beings, as human beings, even God as a human being, can be tempted, but without sin. So the sin has to be somehow after, in a sort of chronological line, the sin itself has to be after the point of temptation in some way. It may be before the point of physical action. Right?
Yes.
But it might be short of the, it has to be after the point of the temptation.
Right.
So that makes me think, what exactly is the difference then between a temptation and the internal sin that Jesus was talking about? Hatred of your brother, lust after someone.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking that that's part of probably, again, what makes this an obnoxious conversation for people is because it is a, if it was just simply, sin is clearly physical action.
Right.
Right. If that was it, then, oh, this would be so much easier.
Right.
Like, you're like, well, I have all these attractions and desires, but I don't act on them. Okay, well, it's not sinful. That's so much easier.
Yeah.
But clearly Jesus says, no, there's a non-physical action and it's still sinful, like sins of the heart and the mind and stuff like that.
That's what it sounds like it's saying.
And it's all, like I said, it's based in the will, like what you actually will. You know, like I you know, these attractions rise up, but I choose not to, like, indulge them. Hmm. These attractions rise up, and I do choose to indulge them. I think I said we've all of us who struggle with not just sin, but like the particular sins to us, we've all gone through that. I think last podcast I mentioned, like, you know, I'm inclined towards being anxious and distrusting of everything, but like when God steps in and says, no, you don't have to, here's the truth, and I see the truth for like some brief moment of time, what should be joy is just miserable because it's like, man, I wanted to be sad and all blah, blah, blah. It's like, I wanted that, which is so weird because it's like, it's awful to be in that thing, but that's what I wanted to indulge. And so it's like, we all understand that sense of like, I want that thing, but I'm going to choose to not.
Right.
All right. Wanting the thing is part of the curse, part of the fallenness of yourself. But choosing is where the sin thing comes in.
Hmm. Okay. And, so it's the action of the will, and that action of the will might still be internal.
Right.
And there's a point that's still internal. Okay.
So the reason I said it becomes obnoxious is because how do you, who are not the same sex attracted Christian, how do you really know what the other person is willing internally or not? I mean, in some way, you got to trust them and take them at their word.
Right.
All right. But if somebody says, you know, oh, look, I just have the attractions, but I've never indulged them. Well, how do you know? It's like, it's another one of those things where it's all internal. And so it's like being able to clearly see whether it's actual or not is difficult. becomes difficult.
Well, maybe that is the area then that has to be dealt with by prayer and confession one to another. What I'm thinking about is this. Let's put it in the heterosexual world for a second. Say I'm a boss and I have a secretary that I'm enamored of. I'm married to my wife, but I have this secretary that I'd like to be able to chase around the desk. But I know that wouldn't be right, so I'm going to not do that. At least the outward chasing, yeah, and trying to seduce this woman. I know that's wrong, so I'm not going to do that. Okay, fine. But it may be that I still am so susceptible in my mind that I can almost not concentrate on my work. I'm just, constantly sort of fantasizing about what I would like to do, but I'm not doing, right? Well, I would think that would be sin, yeah, in the sense that Jesus was talking about, but it wouldn't be something that breaks the physical, threshold we're talking about, but it would need to be worked out of me in sanctification. If I'm trusting God to that God has given me a new heart, then I know that fantasy life of mine is no longer who I really am. Mm. But it's a habit that I've been in, and now I want to get out of. And so it seems right to turn to my pastor, my priest, my Christian friends and say, look, I'm really having trouble with this. Can you guys pray with me and help me through this? And maybe there's a way to unpack that, to break that habit, like smoking or something else, some other habit, something. But it's an internal habit. It's a mental will, a will habit where I choose by my will to focus on that thing and not on other things, you see. Right. So it still would be a sin of the will, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It seems that on the curmudgeonly side, which I'm just using for place marker purposes, they're sure, probably all very nice people. But on the more curmudgeonly side, that seems to be like the main point of contention is how close attraction, temptation, and actual, like, willing, at least internally,
yeah,
they're connected. Like, they're the steps, you know,
right,
two steps.
Right.
Another line that the guy on the curmudgeonly side says is, you cannot define lust without the idea of attraction. Not that attraction and lust are the same thing, but rather that lust comes from attraction. Right? Like, it starts there. Like, it starts there, and then you act on it in some way.
So is his argument that the attraction itself is the sin?
I think the argument is that attraction is not sinful, but it's still fallen. And if you treat it with kid gloves, which is, I think, what they're accusing the Revoice conference of doing, or claiming they're doing, they're kind of treating it with kid gloves or padded room.
Right.
You know,
so
like the bumpers are up, in the bowling alley. If you treat the attraction with kid gloves, it's too easy then to act like the desire itself that gets indulged is not a big deal either. It's almost like you're kind of making the path too easy. It's not that you're saying that the desire is, you're going to jump and say the desire is right. It's rather that for the Christian who's struggling with same-sex attraction, if you say, oh, well, the attraction is no big deal.
Yeah.
Then maybe you'll say, now the lustful desire is bad, but the attraction is no big deal. If you say the attraction is no big deal, then you've made the path from attraction to lust a little too easy. You made it a little too easy for them to just like, well, the attraction is no big deal, then I guess I can just ignore it and not act.
Right.
When the curmudgeonly side's argument is that the attraction itself, because it is inherently disordered, that itself is a big deal.
Yeah.
Same-sex disordered attractions, they're just as much a result of the curse as earthquakes and dental cavities, right? Okay, sure, yes. But a dental cavity is still a big deal. You need to go to the dentist and get that changed, right? You need to get that fixed. So here's my problem is I don't necessarily see either side as wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, on the one hand, I'm like, yes, attractions, temptations are not sinful because Jesus got tempted, and for temptations to mean anything, there must have been something attractive to him about the idea of changing stones into bread or jumping off the top of the temple or whatever. There had to be something. Temptation doesn't mean anything if it doesn't attract something, right?
Yeah.
So there had to be something there. So attraction in itself is not sinful, all right? But Even attractions to the wrong things are not in itself sinful, but it's still a big deal. It's still disordered, all right? And so while we have to say attraction is not sinful, if you're struggling with same-sex attraction, what you're doing is not sinful, if you're not already fallen into it, but it's still something that needs to be helped. Does that make sense?
I think I see where you're making a distinction there. I'm trying to figure out how... well, there's two things that come to mind. First of all, let me say this. It seems to me the difference that between a temptation and an attraction might be the temptation comes from the devil. Mm-hmm. The attraction is part of the fallenness of our human nature, or maybe not even fallenness. Maybe we are meant to be attracted and it's just a disordered love. Mm-hmm. It's a love that should be held, but it's just in the wrong spot. Mm-hmm. We talked last time, let's talk about that second part first. We talked last time about how often I think homosexual attraction or homosexual desire may be simply misguided friendship, because friendship is a very severe, but in a positive way, a very strong,
intense.
Intense reality, you know, and the attraction between two friends is something that is very painful if broken. All right, if the relationship is broken, it can be as painful as marriages breaking up, or maybe dating relationships breaking up, heartbreak. So that's a possibility. But the first thing maybe is important to decide about, too, and that is it may be that temptation itself is not in us. Maybe the temptation is actually from the outside. We're told in the scripture that that no temptation comes from God. In other words, the temptations have to come from some other place. But the temptation is engaging with the thing you're talking about, which is this humanness of us. And it disorders our loves. It's asking us to put a lower love above an upper love. Love your secretary more than your wife, or love your secretary more than the law of God, which is this loving God, not loving God. Well, so maybe the distinction between temptation and desire is the distinction between what comes from the outside and what's actually a part of who we are. And so maybe we should use the terms that way when we're talking about these things. If that's the case, if we assume that framework for a second, then Jesus was tempted and sinned not. Jesus never, though, had disordered desires in that sense. All right. So if our homosexual attraction is considered a desire, then it is a sin because it's out of order. It seems like it's an out of order love. But here's my problem with that. All of our loves are screwed up.
Right.
Why single that one out?
Yeah.
We have all sorts of problems there, and that it seems to me the sanctification process. So to single out homosexual attraction as a disordered love, while it may be, again, true, it may not be very helpful,
right,
because all of our loves are out of order, and the sanctification process seems to me is the process of God reordering all those things.
So
maybe there's no point in taking that curmudgeonly take that says that the desire itself is out of order.
Yeah.
It's clear that it's a... I mean, if your sexual desire is rightly ordered when it's heterosexual and it's not rightly ordered when it's homosexual, it can be out of order in the heterosexual side in lots of other ways.
Right.
So, I don't know. I
hear what you're saying. I mean, the curmudgeonly side, it's like My snarky millennial self wants
Good.
To be like
that's what I want to hear.
Wants to be like yes is like yes you're absolutely right. To desire what God forbids is a sin. Okay, so
right,
like so what? Like what we can't. Welcome to the fallen human condition.
That's
like,
right.
We can't do anything about that. That's kind of the point. It's
has
like
there ever
we need
been
a savior?
Has there ever been 5 minutes in a row that you haven't desired the wrong thing in the wrong order at some point?
At some point, and it's like. It feels like what happens is that the curmudgeonly side wants to, and for the guy who I'm quoting, I feel like he must bring this up at some point because the guy's writings are just like that. But in general, the curmudgeonly side seems to want to emphasize really hard on the like the doctrinal, this is what disordered desires are, this is what sin is, we can't lose that. But in emphasizing that, it's like you almost like they just it's almost like there's the potential to bar the way from anybody even wanting to come forward because mm-hmm. it's just law mm-hmm. without mm-hmm. any grace without right. any with the gospel.
Right. That's right.
It's like I mean the point of realizing that you know to desire what God forbids is a sin full stop and then realize well you know what all of our desires are completely screwed up. Even our desires to do good can arguably be said that they're screwed up.
When I think doing, that's right.
There was a this is a side issue, but there was a video I saw yesterday about a lady priest who was arguing what forgiveness, why forgiveness was good, why forgiving people who really mean to you is good, why forgiveness is really good because it sets you free from their toxicity and allows you to like, which is not false, but there was this sense that forgiveness was all about you.
Oh, I see, right.
Like forgiveness is all about your empowerment and your ability to be free from things that drag you down and about your self-actualization and stuff like that. Even forgiveness, which is like an incredibly godly attribute, even it can be grounded in complete selfishness.
Oh, yeah, got it.
Like, even it can be grounded
that
in complete
makes sense.
Selfishness. So it's
sure.
like... Even our even our righteousness is filthy rags, it almost seems, right?
Yes.
So it's like pointing out that the desire itself is fundamentally broken, not just in acting on it, but just having it is fundamentally broken is true, and we don't need to lose that. But again, it may be another instance where in this specific case with the Revoice Conference and even specifically dealing with someone, whether they're Christian or no, who's dealing with or struggling with same-sex attractions, that may be something that's true, but not helpful in that it's not the whole story,
mm-hmm.
right? It's
mm-hmm.
almost like, yeah, it's like, and maybe the danger with Revoice, which I don't see, and we'll have to see what happens after the conference at the end of July, but maybe the real danger is the potential for if the curmudgeonly side is erring one way, where they just harp on the law so much that it just seems like there's, well, why would anyone want to be a part of that?
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's my world where I'm just hopelessly lost in this. I don't want any part of that. The Revoice Conference, maybe their danger, and maybe this is what the curmudgeonly side is worried about, may err the other way, where they err so they start to err so far on grace and graciousness and laying one in that they're not going to get the whole, like, the whole picture of the gospel.
Right.
The whole picture
right.
of redemption, which is the lostness that needs to be saved.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, what occurred to me is that the way we're thinking here might lead people to believe that that we shouldn't be judging any kind of sin, in a sense, because everybody is living with disordered loves, and everybody is listening to the wrong voices and having to sift through that. And the more we read in the scripture, the more we rightly order our loves, and the more we grow and mature and in the faith and so on, we rightly order the work of sanctification in our lives is going on. And but that means that we're still doing that, and so there's things that are disordered. Well, in that case, you hear the scripture, don't judge lest you be judged, you know. We shouldn't be doing that with one another. And Paul even says, I don't even judge myself. I don't judge other people. I can't even judge me because I'm not smart enough. I got to leave that to God. He's the only one who sees me properly. When he says jog left, I move left. When he says jog right, I go right, you know. But if I start saying, well, I need to move to the further to the left, or right, or whatever. I'm actually judging myself, and my judgments are faulty. So better to have him do it. However, we do have a revealed word. We do have it, and what we want to be able to do is allow God to judge me and you and the world. And I think that's what the prayer is about, right? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Your will be done here as it is there, right?
Yeah.
Let it be that way. And let me just follow your will. Let me just do it the way you want to do it at every moment of the day. That's how we're gonna get there. So that means that on one hand, we don't single out homosexual attraction as any more sinful than any other misguided love outside, you know. But at the same time, we don't allow it to stand as though, because it can actually do damage, like you were saying. Yeah. The curmudgeons actually get some of it right, that, you know, it can open the door to things. You know, people are tempted by different things, obviously. And so if I'm, for example, tempted by gambling, then ministering to people in Tunica, the gambling casinos down there, may not be the calling I have. That's not to say that other Christians don't have that calling. They might be.
Right.
In fact, they may not be so untouched by gambling that they can wander through casinos all the time and not be tempted to do fall into any kind of bad habits.
Right.
In the same way, if I'm tempted by homosexual attraction, that's the area that I want to be on the lookout for. I don't want to place myself in the position to allow that very sensitive thing to affect me and draw me into real sin.
Yeah. This whole thing, Phil, just to step back from it a little bit, it feels a bit like a microcosm of just trying to engage the culture as a Christian, period, regardless of what the issue is. Because it seems like the two sides, the curmudgeons and the conferenceites, it's like those two sides. It's like, how do we effectively engage a non-Christian culture, or how do we, in the conference is the word, it's supposed to be for Christians.
It's really
how do we engage this thing that's a big deal in the culture? How do we deal with it in-house?
Right.
How do we actually engage these things?
Right.
On the one hand, and two, how do we maintain the distinct Christian identity at the same time?
Right.
Because those are like the two, I feel like those are the two sort of polarities that pull at us all at the same time. I remember
that's the tension in which we live.
And when I was getting my MFA in creative writing, I took a class called Forms of Fiction, which is a class that it wasn't really about writing stories as much as studying different kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great one because it was all about genres, which was fantastic. But one of the genres we studied was religious. And by religious, they meant Christian, because that's like the big one. And they wanted people to do reports on each of the different genres. So I immediately was like, I'll do the Christian one. And what I basically got up and ultimately said is that being a Christian, like a true Christian writer, you're stuck, not stuck, but you're caught on the horns of an interesting dilemma. One is, how do you, I don't remember exactly how I put it, but it basically, like, the one horn is, how do you make actually effective art, if I can put it that way?
Sure.
And be faithful
at
the same time, and not like neither one of those be sacrificed. You know, it could be responded by a Chestertonian balance of like 100% on one side, 100% on the other. But the point is, that's always the dilemma. How do I deport myself well in the name of Christ? How do I deport Christ's name well and write good stories at the same time that actually want to get read and aren't just, you know, pigeonholed into one audience? I'm sorry, I'm going to soapbox. Anyway, the point is that it's that same sort of problem. It's like, how do we actually engage with this culture we live in, both outside the church and even inside the church? Because it's like, even if it's in-house, it doesn't mean we all agree, right? How do we engage these things and still remain faithful to who we are and faithful to the truths that we've been given and that, as the church, we've been entrusted with?
Right.
So on and so forth. How do we do that? And I feel like you're seeing this fight is definitely an in-house fight, because it's really those two. It seems to me, just from that 30,000 foot view, is like those two polarities, like, you know, yelling at each other, if I could put it that way, very politely yelling at each other. You know, we have to engage this somehow. We cannot, you know, compromise with our fundamental central doctrines. It's like, you know, and in a way, they're both right. And so I guess I would encourage the Revoice guys, because I'm not sure the curmudgeonly ones would want to hear me, but I encourage everyone, actually. It's a thing I noticed growing up in college, is that for some reason, when there's like something too far to one side, the temptation to balance it is not to go to the middle, but to go running all the way to the other
side
as a reaction against it.
Right.
No matter left, right, or center, you're always a reactionary to something, right? That there's always a potential to be a reactionary to something.
Yeah.
And if Revoice is an attempt, however clumsily, an attempt to try and pull it a little bit back towards the mean and try and say we're engaging it as faithful Christians, then bravo, all right? And, you know, I'm they're good, all right? That's good. But they need to be wary of just being reactionaries, all right? You don't want to be like there was a mean, curmudgeonly, hyper-conservative, you kids get off my lawn kind of Christianity out there.
Right.
I think we talked about a couple of weeks ago. And that it was just being mean, so we're going to be the nice ones.
Right.
And we're going to be so nice that we don't say anything you do is wrong. And that's like, that's the danger of the other side.
Sure. I think that's well said. That's the problem, like you say, with a lot of different deals. Let me push this a little further, because I'm interested in how you would go and see the benefit. How can you get the curmudgeon to see the benefit of the others, the conferencers, or the reverse?
The conferenceites.
Conferenceites, there you go, right. How would you get the conferenceites then to see the benefit of the curmudgeons? I see some of that in them already. I think they've bent over backward, I think, to describe how they aren't departing from an orthodox view.
Those 6 points by the Center for Faith, Sexuality, and Gender.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
Yeah. Sounds pretty sound to me.
I mean, having some sort of concrete reference point like that is good. Because even if they deviate from it, you can point out and say, you guys are deviating from what you promised.
From your own verbiage. But here's what I was thinking. Our culture is so hypersexualized anyway, right? Mm-hmm. We think that our identity is wrapped up in our sexuality. I mean, I'm so tired of seeing these, you know, Cialis commercials on television. You know very well that human beings have, as they get older, their sexual desire fades a little. That's not a bad thing. That's not inherently bad. But we've got this idea that we're all like 20 years old. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we're not acting like 20-year-olds, maybe we're, you know, oh no, we're going to lose our identity as sexual beings. Yeah, we're losing our human. Well, God has created a life that's much, much larger than just our sexual desires. And yet what we've done is we have sort of emphasized sex so much ever since the 60s, so much so that we think that's the be all and end all. In fact, all that we do in life is so that we might have the kind of sexual satisfaction that we want, which has made sex idolatrous, I think, an idolatry.
Yeah. I mean, it's another instance to harp back on
an idol,
an older point of mine. It is another instance where this is another thing that is a threat to the body itself. But you know, it's like, the sexual impulse dropping off over time is how it works, right? That's just how it is. There could be reasons for it. They're like medical or health related. We're not talking about that. We're just talking about the natural dropping off over time.
And I'm talking about a reduction in desire, not an end to sexuality.
Right.
You're still a sexual couple. You're still engaged with each other in your marriage. But what I'm saying is, it's not the only thing that's important. And what happens, one of the results of making it so important is, on the heterosexual side, is, you know, all these advertisements of 60-year-olds, you know, holding hands and trying to sell you to act like a 20-year-old again. But on the homosexual side, the temptation is to think, I have nothing but a bleak future. You know, if I follow Jesus, I'm going to have to live with this desire at the intensity of a 20-year-old without ever having any kind of outlet for it. And I'm sympathetic with that to a degree. But what if the answer to that is the same answer as that we would give any kind of inordinate desire, and that is to paint a picture of the glories of the thing that God has intended for it, rather than focusing on the fact that you don't have what you want, which is, in a sense, a kind of self-centered thing. How about if you get such a picture of what it is that God intends for sexuality that you actually find yourself thanking God that you weren't able to go down that other road, you know? That lustful or homosexually attracted or, you know, whatever, a road that you're great because you know that it's a dead end, you see. You can't know that it's a dead end when you're only thinking of it. But if you're thinking about the bigger picture, then maybe that's the answer to all of these things, to sort of break it all free from its intensity and see it within the context of God's economy for more than just sexuality.
I mean, when it comes out, revoice may happen, and the fallout from it is bad. Mm-hmm. Like, it turns out it was, like, a really bad, like, it was capitulation and whatever. They tried, whatever they intended resulted was not good. It may turn out that it was fantastic. It may turn out that really it was, we all hyped it up for no big deal. But regardless of what happens in the moment, we need to be gracious to each other as we're trying to navigate something that is extremely difficult.
Well, I think you've done a very good job of summarizing that, so I'll leave that there.
Anything for you to recommend, sir?
Well, I want to recommend a book on, since we've been talking about sexuality, I'd like to recommend a book by John Piper and I think Wayne Grudem. I should look it up before I tell you, shouldn't I? Called Biblical Manhood and Womanhood.
Right.
And it's got a lot of information in it. It's sort of a collection of questions answered about every possible aspect right. of sexuality.
Right. Recovering Biblical Manhood
Recovering,
and
that's
womanhood.
It. Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood, I think it's called. I've used it several times in the past, and the questions are very interesting and thoughtful answers, not quick answers to some of the very more complicated issues.
Right. It was specifically, I remember, it was a response to evangelical feminism is what
right.
they said. And it's basically a collection of complementarian thought responding
right.
to egalitarian thought.
That's right.
But it definitely discusses like the Bible's role on gender.
Thanks.
So I'm going to recommend a podcast that I just discovered. It's called Pints with Aquinas. Pints as in P-I-N-T-S, you know, it comes in pints. You know, that one.
Yeah, that.
Pints with Aquinas.
Thomas Aquinas?
Yeah, Thomas Aquinas.
Oh, very good.
It's a podcast run by, from what I can tell, I'm guessing. First I thought he was New Zealander, but now I think he's Australian. He's a Catholic Australian who lives in Georgia. Very interesting combination. And the whole gist of his podcast is, if you could pull up a bar stool to a table with Thomas Aquinas and ask him anything, what would you ask him? All right. And basically his podcast episodes are dealing with like things that we wish we could ask him. And it's sometimes it's just him because he's read the Summa and he knows the Summa, but most of the time he brings in like, you know, Thomistic scholars, most of them are priests, and he asks these questions and they hash out what would Thomas say about these things and what would be his position on this stuff. So, like, one of the last ones I listened to was, what was it? Episode 109, Would Aquinas Listen to Metallica? Which is fantastic. It is a discussion on how Thomas Aquinas defined beauty. And it was...
Wow. Well, we need to hear that one.
It was an absolute blast to listen to. My apologies to my more ardent Protestant listeners for recommending a Catholic. They are very, very Catholic. Okay, I'll give that caveat. As in, sometimes they're very rah-rah Catholic.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that's okay. We can be rah-rah in our own ways. But it's just, if you want to get more into Thomas Aquinas in a fun way, and you love Australian accents as much as I do, just check it out. It's called Pints with Aquinas. And if you want a good place to start, that Metallica one is a perfect place to start. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a very good one. I'm going to have to listen to that myself.
All right, so I guess that's all for today. Thank you for joining us. This has been From the Center, and we'll see you next time.
See you next time.